This show, Story in the Public Square, began as a modestly attended, if brilliant, academic conference at Salve Regina University. Then we honored today's guest with the 2014 Pell Center Prize for Story in the Public Square, for using story to make the world a better place. His acceptance speech was so moving, so incisive, and so eloquent about the power of story that a public television executive in the audience asked if she could broadcast it. She did, and here we are. He's Danny Strong this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To do that, we sit down every week with the best storytellers around, filmmakers, authors, journalists, and more, to make sense of the big stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Danny Strong, one of the most productive talents in front of or behind a camera today. He's an actor, an Emmy-winning screenwriter, and co-creator and executive producer of the smash hit Empire, among many other achievements. Danny, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So we owe you a huge debt because it was your acceptance speech for Story in the Public, for the Pell Center Prize for Story in the Public Square in 2014 that really gave rise to the show. So thank you so much for joining us and being with us today.
Yeah, thank you. I'm so flattered. It meant so much to me when you guys told me about that. I couldn't believe it.
Well, one of the things that you talked about in that day was sort of how you became a writer in the first place, and the power of story in your own life. Can you walk us back through that, beginning with sort of what drew you to being a writer in the first place?
What did I say? Can you remind
me? It was brilliant.
I started writing for a few reasons. One was I was an actor, and it's very hard to get work as an actor, and so I wrote a script for me to star in, which is a very not uncommon thing for actors to do. And I found that it did two things for me. It didn't further my acting career, unfortunately, because no one wanted me in the piece that I'd written. But it did two things. One, it just gave me a creative outlet away from acting that was very healthy, that I enjoyed. And then, more significantly, it gave me an outlet to express things that I was angry about in society and in public debate and in the news. And it turned into a way for me to sort of deal with things that were making me really angry on a daily basis.
And so you were consciously aware of sort of the social impact of, the potential for social impact from your art.
Well, I knew as someone who watches a lot of TV and films and theater that I loved art that had social impact in it. You know, for me personally, I find it the most powerful. I like that I'm learning something, and I think it actually makes work more entertaining because it's more dynamic, you know, and it's more thought-provoking. So I initially, you know, and I think that's ultimately what makes what you come to write yourself are things, in the best version of writing, I think, are what things you want to read and what things you want to see is what you end up writing yourself.
So what time period was this when you began writing, and how old were you, and what were some of the things in the news that were bothering you?
Just to give it, you know, sort of a... Well, I started writing when I was 25 to 26, when was that? I don't even know.
That would have been in late 90s, early 2000s, somewhere around there.
Well, I will say, you know, this is sort of jumping ahead a little bit, but... the first script of mine that I was able to sell, I sold it as a pitch and then wrote it and then it became a film, was the script Recount, which was about the Florida recount in the 2000 election. And that script, which I wrote in 2005, 2006, You know, that was before even the Democrats had retaken the House and the Senate in 2006. So from 2000 to 2005, if you're a Democrat, which I happen to be, it was a very dark time. And it felt as if it was never going to end. You know, you had 5 years in minority power. And that film, to me, telling the story of the recount was a way for me to talk about all the things I was angry about in politics over that five-year period. It was as much about that whole era than it was just about the Florida recount.
So so that was the 2000 election. Just walk us through what that election was and how it got hung up in Florida and ultimately went to the Supreme Court. Which was the genesis, I guess, for recount.
Sure. The 2000 election, Bush versus Gore. Incredibly close election. It comes down to the state of Florida, in which at the end of the election, Bush is up by, I believe, 536 votes.
That's right.
So it goes into a recount. And in over the next 36, some people say 37 days, you have different different markers for how long the recount actually lasted. There was this street fight on the streets of Florida.
An actual physical street fight?
Sometimes it turned physical, for sure. In Miami, there was this thing called the Brooks Brothers Mob, in which Republican protesters, you know, were protesting the recount in Miami-Dade. And so it got that nickname because it got a little violent. I think it didn't get nearly as violent as the name gives it. I interviewed so many people down there, on Republican and Democrat, and I interviewed a Republican political operative who renamed it the Penny Loafer Protest, which I loved.
That's a great name.
Just rebrand.
Oh, that is good.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
That is a wonderful name.
Yeah, the Penny Loafer Protest.
I like that, yeah.
So then famously, the recount ended when the U.S. Supreme Court shut down the process. Infamously known as Bush v. Gore, what it's actually known as well, and that was the that was the Florida recount.
So you're watching, you're observing all this as it's happening, and then later when you decide to write this, you just mentioned that you interviewed a lot of people. So talk about your methodology. That you didn't just take what you saw on TV or read in the news. You went well beyond that to get a real understanding of the story, but also to give you an understanding that would allow you to write the script. Am I getting that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So as the recount was happening, I actually didn't follow the minutiae of it day to day. I was so enraged by the whole thing and so disgusted by it on multiple factors, not just partisan factors. You know, there were things that Gore did that made me mad, and I just kind of got turned off, as many people did. Although followed the big moments. And so when I came up with the idea of doing it as a film 5 years later, I didn't remember, I remember very few of the details from when it actually happened. And I just started reading books on it. And there was all these books that had been written about it that all bombed because they all came out right after 9/11. And no one wanted to read about the Florida recount.
Talking about bad timing.
Yeah. And there were four books in particular that were just about the ground fight. So I had a tremendous amount of source material, but then I went and I interviewed, I don't know, I think I did around 40 interviews with the actual participants. So many of the people I portray in the film in both parties I spoke to. Which was fantastic, and I had never done anything like that before. I was not a journalist. I had never actually even written a nonfiction piece. I'd actually never even written a drama. I'd only been writing comedies. So the whole thing was me flying by the seat of my pants, figuring it out from interview to interview, and it was very scary and very exciting all at the same time.
So there's a through line in a lot of the work that you've done is, and a lot, particularly a lot of the writing work that you've done, is it's really smart content. So Game Change, Recount, Rebel in the Rye. So that's, you know, a film, a biopic about one of America's more mercurial authors, J.D. Salinger.
Sure.
Boy, that's an understatement. Well, more mercurial, isn't it?
So you know, how do you find source content for a production like that?
Well, in the case of Rebel in the Rye, there had been a few books written on J.D. Salinger, and the whole thing was actually inspired by me walking into a bookstore and seeing a new biography out on him, knowing almost nothing about him. except that I was a fan from high school, and I knew that he was a very mysterious figure. You know, when I was in high school, he
was... Which was in California.
California, but he was a national figure of mystery.
Yeah.
So it was before the internet. So there was very little. He had just disappeared, right? That was all that was known.
He lived somewhere in New Hampshire, and he was spotted every month coming to the grocery.
Very mysterious figure. Yeah, yeah. I didn't even get that much of the spotted every month. It was where is J.D. Salinger, you know? And it was sort of a national mystery. So when I saw this book, I thought, well, that's interesting. I should read that. And as I was reading it, I thought, wow, I was just actually quite inspired by it, inspired by his journey, and was really stunned by the fact that the story of Holden Caulfield, this troubled teenager, came from a guy who had suffered severe war trauma, and that so much of what had happened to him, of him going away to the woods of New Hampshire, the daily meditation, you know, ending up in a room for several decades writing and not showing that writing to anyone, that it's not a big stretch to label that as untreated PTSD. And I thought, wow, that's an incredible story.
Yeah.
So I was really taken by that and decided to write a script about it.
So at what point with sort of, you consult all these sources, when do you know that it's time to start writing and stop researching?
That's a great question, and you can really go down a rabbit hole of research and not write.
Yeah.
And also the research can get overwhelming, especially for a screenplay, which is 120 pages, but if it was truncated into prose, it'd be almost 40 pages, right?
Wow.
So you can get overwhelmed by the research and feel lost in the story in a way of how do you turn this into something. And so for me, I try to do it in phases where I usually read about two books and then I feel as if I have a sense of what happened, right? So what happens? And then from there, I'll probably do an outline. I'll construct the story. Then once I have the outline, if it's, you know, these real life stories we've been talking about, I'll try and go interview people at the outline stage and at least just get some of my main characters that I'm going to portray to see if I can talk to them if they're still alive. Then from there, I'll have a base of information that's pretty strong, and I may go and write the first draft at that point, or I may read one more source if there's even more books. But what I like to do is I like to, because these things go on for a long time. By go on, I mean you do lots of rewrites. You know, I'll rewrite scripts. I don't know, 15, 20, 24.
Really?
I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
And so I like to take in new information in between passes, because that new information or these new sources, maybe I'll find something new that can help solve some problems I have from the previous draft.
Interesting.
So I'll write something, turn it in, get some notes, and then before I go write the next draft, I'll read a new book. Maybe I'll try and go to the next round of people in my interviews. If they're sort of a tier one, I'll reach out to the tier two. And then it's just sort of more information building on itself that I can put into a script that has been structured. So there's already a shape to it, so this information just doesn't get lost in this sort of cave of I don't know what to do with all this. I actually know exactly what to do with it because I already have a foundation that I'm working off of.
Still, though, as you go through this process, start to finish, you're collecting a wealth of detail from reading, from the interviews you do. You could get buried in detail. How do you decide what detail that you've, additional new detail that you uncover belongs or doesn't belong? I mean, that has to be a frustrating and very selective process.
Well, you have to.
Because there's so much good detail in any good
story. Right? There's so much great stuff.
There's so much.
The key is sticking to your story. So whatever the story is you're trying to tell is, for me, anything that is superfluous to that, even if it's wonderful, if it doesn't belong in this narrative, then it doesn't belong there. And, you know, I always have to remind myself, this is not a documentary. This is not a nonfiction book. I'm not telling the total story. If someone wants the total story, they're going to need to go to a nonfiction book in which someone much smarter and more talented will have laid that out for them, you know? I'm telling a very specific story, which is the movie or the TV show. And I try to do that in a way that is truthful, but that has a specific spine, and that spine is usually dictated by a theme. And that the theme of that story is ultimately what I'm trying to say, and that in the information that I gather will tie into, you know, the plot, which is, you know, the sequence of events that are going to be in the film, because that's going to ultimately inform the theme that I'm trying to point out.
So let's take this in sort of specific.
Did that make sense? Was that?
Yeah, no, totally. Absolutely fascinating.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. And if you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me as he does every week in the co-host chair is G. Wayne Miller, the author of 17 books. He's also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Danny Strong, a prolific talent on screen and behind the camera. Danny is an actor, an Emmy-winning screenwriter, and the co-creator and executive producer of the smash hit Empire, whose upcoming sixth season will reportedly be its last. He's on Twitter, too, at Danny Strong, all one word. I want to explore it, though, a little bit deeper with something that, one of my favorite works of yours, which is The Butler.
Oh, thanks.
So this is a sweeping account of one man's life, but also the American Civil Rights Movement.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that story and how that spine stretches
great
out to tell the whole
question.
Story.
And I think it's a great way to sort of discuss what I just said, you know, or to, as an example of, okay, hands down the most complicated thing I've ever written.
Really?
Is The Butler. Yeah, without a doubt. It was.
Well, the sweep of history. You're talking about
the sweep of
so
history. Exactly. And how do you maintain a theme, a dramatic tension, a story within all that scope of history? Now, it began from an article by Will Haygood in the Washington Post, which was a profile on a White House butler named Eugene Allen. And it was a beautiful story. It kind of captured the nation's attention. You know, it was one of those just, it was viral story. And Sony Pictures bought it, and the great producer Warren Ziskin was the producer of it. And they came to me to see if I could figure out how to adapt it. And I was incredibly flattered to be brought such a beautiful piece of material. I found out I was the second choice. Okay.
So a little less flattered than
that. No, it's, you know, well, the first choice was, you know, one of the great screenwriters of our time. So I was like, I'll be second choice to that guy any day of the week, you know? Yeah, I was very flattered, actually. And so they, and I thought when I read it, well, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do this movie, and I wasn't going to do it. I just didn't know what there was, and then I thought, well, I know it's a great piece of material. So I started researching. I just started researching the civil rights movement. I thought, if you're going to do a story about an African-American butler in the White House over many years, through many administrations, that there has to be some sort of civil rights angle to it. And as I was reading different civil rights accounts about all the great moments, you know, the Montgomery bus boycott and the Freedom Riders and the sit-ins and Selma. And as I kept reading these stories, I thought, these stories are amazing. I want to be there. I don't want to be in the White House. I want to be in Selma. And I want to be at a sit-in in Nashville. And I want to be on the Freedom Bus. And then I had a eureka moment, which was, oh, why don't I give the butler a son who was in the civil rights movement. So if I do that, then he'll have a son who will be in all these events that I really want to dramatize. The president will be dealing with the crisis that the son is in the middle of, and the butler, who's in the middle of the two of them, will be serving the president, who's dealing with these crises, as he knows his son is down there in the middle of them. Yeah. And it just flooded into my head. And it was very exciting because I thought, this is great, you know, like this could be really great and really ambitious. And then I knew that I was going to have to fictionalize the story. So that was one of the first things that I said when I went back to the producer, is I said, I want to do a fictional version of this story. I don't know how to do Mr. Allen's story. I think it's a jumping off point for a fictional family that will intersect us through all these historical moments. And then my ambition for it started to grow, and I thought, well, how can I make this you know, some sort of definitive tale about the civil rights movement. And so by asking that question, the answer was, well, why don't I start, you know, the character is a, you know, working in the fields, you know, in the cotton fields, and that'll be almost as if it's slavery, even though it was the 1920s, but it'll still feel like it.
Sure.
And then I'll end it with him and his son watching Obama's inauguration, and it'll be from slavery to Obama. And that was the pitch for the movie.
It's a phenomenal film, and folks haven't seen it, they should.
Thank you so much.
I remember, because we've met before, you've also talked about sort of the angels that helped make that film a reality.
Yeah.
The challenges of producing a film that is focused on the civil rights era, focused on African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us a little bit about that part of the story.
Well, it's the kind of thing that, it's not as if anyone wants to make this kind of movie in Hollywood, right? And the fact that Sony had went and bought the article was I thought, really cool. And it was Amy Pascal read the article, and she immediately thought, I want to do something like this. Laura Ziskin, very passionate producer about these issues, really iconic producer, really wanted to do it. And then we were, once I wrote the script, we got Lee Daniels, you know, great Oscar-nominated African-American director to come on board. It was this great team, and then the studio didn't make it. So they didn't make it. And then we sent the script to every studio in Hollywood. They all passed. Then every second tier financer passed. And Laura Ziskin, who was dying of cancer at the time, she just was so passionate about this film. And she started going around to people, wealthy African Americans, to see if they would put money into it. And it was old school producing of just door-to-door, cold calling, that sort of thing. And eventually we started to raise some money, and then we raised some more money. And the film was financed almost entirely with private equity, which is incredibly unusual.
Wow.
Yeah.
And of course, it went on to win a lot of awards.
Well, almost, but.
Was that your first association with Lee Daniels?
Yes. Yeah, so we met on that project.
Okay, and that led to some other collaboration with Lee Daniels.
Yes, that led to Empire, I mean, directly.
Talk about that. I mean,
well, so I was, we were in post-production on The Butler, and we got pretty close in post-production, where he, you know, often the writer is sent away at that point, like, thank you, bye-bye.
Done your job,
we would like you not around. We actually would have liked you not around a long time ago. But so I was, but when I get into post, I shift from a writer to a producer. I stop worrying about my script, and I can become more ruthless on cutting than almost anybody else. And I'll say, no, cut that scene.
Really?
And yeah, and Lee loved it. So Lee loved how honest I was about giving him feedback and notes, to the point where he would just start giving me all the cuts to give him notes on. And he said, we got to do something else. And I said, well, let me think about it, you know? So I was in LA driving around, and there was a news show about, I mean, there was a news story on the radio about Puffy, Sean Combs, and some deal he'd closed. And I just remember thinking, hip-hop is such a dynamic, exciting world. I wonder if there's some sort of musical that I could do with Lee in hip-hop. And then I immediately, you know, and these things happen for me very fast, or they don't happen at all. That's sort of my process, is that it floods in once I get a sort of breakthrough, or it will never flood in, and it's time to move on to another project. But almost instantly, I thought about, well, what about King Lear or The Lion in Winter? And what about doing that in a hip-hop empire? And then I just sort of took those archetypes and I created the foundation for what became Empire. You know, I thought, okay, so what if Jay-Z was older and he had three sons and he's dying and his wife went to prison for the drug money that started the Empire, the record label, and it was all, which is Eleanor Aquitaine from Wine and Winter, you know? So I just took the archetypes from those two pieces, and then I thought, oh, well, this is what I should do with Lee. I mean, this could be this really cool movie musical that I could do with Lee.
And so you originally conceived of this as a film.
I conceived it as a film, and then called him, said I had an idea. I ended up in New York a few weeks later. We had lunch, and I pitched it to him, and he really loved it. And then he called me a week later, and he just said, I can't stop thinking about it, but I think it's a TV show instead of a movie. And I said, I think you're right. You know, a TV show's, but the best ones are all about families fighting. That's what this whole thing is. This is about a family at war for itself over, you know, quote, the empire. And then I just remember in the phone call saying, yeah, it could be like Black Dynasty. And he started screaming, yes, Black Dynasty, yes. And that was sort of the beginning of it.
And you get into, I mean, it's obviously great TV and great drama, mm-hmm. but you also get into some real social issues on that show in terms of yeah. drug dealing, drug use, the effects of both of those on individuals, mm-hmm. incarceration, mental illness. I'm assuming that was not accidental, bringing those socially relevant yeah. themes into this incredible hit.
It was in the DNA of the pitch when I met Lee for lunch. So when I pitched him the show, or not the show, the movies, it was a movie, I said this will be a treatise on homophobia. And that the father who heads the empire should hand over the empire to his middle son, who's the great talent of the family, but because he's gay, he won't do it. And that's going to be the central conflict of this film, is him eventually coming to terms with the fact that his son is gay. So the whole thing came as a discussion in a diatribe on homophobia. And that's where, you know, for me, I my head always goes to, well, what's the bigger idea? What's the social issue? Where's the muckraking? You know, because if I'm going to spend a year, 2 years writing it, knowing that it may never go anywhere, and spending all that time on something, I want to dive into something that I'm angry about and muckrake about it. You know, that's sort of my favorite term to use when I think about, okay, where's the muckraking in this project that makes it...
It's a great, great way to describe
yeah.
what you do.
We've got about 35 seconds left. Season 6, the final season for Empire.
Yeah.
We're not going to ask you for any spoilers.
Sure.
But what should the audience expect?
Well, it's season 6 of Empire. It's in the final season. It's just going to be crazy, you know? I mean, that show rides, lives on a tightrope. And sometimes we fall off, and then we'll get right back on, and then walk, you know, for quite a while, and it'll be real exciting, and then we fall off again, you know? And it was born that way. It's been that way the entire time, and I have no doubt that season 6 is going to be up on that tightrope.
We're looking forward to it. Danny Strong, the show is Empire. Thank you so much for being
Thank
with us.
Thank you.
That's all the time.
That was a lot of fun, guys.
That's all the
Thank
time
you.
We have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. He's Wayne. I'm Jim, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.